Hear these words from the fifth chapter of Matthew's Gospel. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go. First, be reconciled to your brother or sister. Then come and offer your gift. May God bless the reading and hearing of these sacred words. Jesus was serious about worship. We know this because of the gospel witness that points again and again to its truth. As a young boy, we know that Jesus wandered away from his parents on an out-of-town trip, not to go see a movie or meet up with friends, but to go to church, to go to the temple. Jesus was serious about worship. Throughout his preaching and teaching ministry, Jesus spoke with passion and intention, with instruction and command about the centrality of worship to all who would follow him. Luke's gospel tells us that it was his custom to worship. It was his custom to worship in his local synagogue each Sabbath. Jesus was a regular worshiper. Jesus was serious about worship. Of course, Jesus also taught that worship of God is possible anywhere and encouraged everywhere. He told a woman at the well in John's gospel that the location of our worship matters far less than its content. He said, God is spirit, and those who worship God do so in spirit and in truth. Jesus was serious about worship. At the end of his earthly life, gathering his disciples in that upper room for a ritual that would become a central sacrament of the Christian movement, that time set apart to commune with God and one another, Jesus, from beginning to end, was serious about worship, serious about that time set apart, that time reserved for humbling ourselves in reverence and in praise before God, that time when we listen for God's voice that quiets the cacophony of competing claims to our lives. This morning's few verses from Matthew's gospel are striking precisely because we know how serious Jesus was about worship. Here Jesus is speaking to his disciples in the message we call the Sermon on the Mount. The sermon, Matthew chapter 5 through 7, is filled with the kinds of teachings that have come to define Christian living and therefore might have lost some of their radical intent. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the mourners, the hungry, the meek, the merciful, the peacemakers. You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before others. You've been told to love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Forgive as you have been forgiven, so you also must forgive one another. And just before the verses I read this morning, Jesus speaks to his disciples about the spiritual danger of anger, the spiritual risk of resentment. And then he gives this real-life, practical, relatable example. If you are at the altar, that is, if you are at the sacred place, the place of worship, if you are in an encounter with God's glory and you remember that someone has something against you somewhere, leave immediately and be reconciled before returning to worship. Now, we know that Jesus spoke in parables, that Jesus used metaphors, employed hyperbole to bring greater clarity to his message, greater resonance to his audience. But let me suggest to you this morning that this particular passage from the Sermon on the Mount is no exaggeration, nor is it hyperbolic. Instead, I am convinced that these instructions from Jesus have deep, practical, personal, literal meaning for the lives of his disciples. And here is that meaning. Reconciliation is a prerequisite for right worship. Interpersonal peace precedes proper praise. Now, I would assume it's non-controversial for me this morning to observe that "I'm sorry" is among the most difficult phrases for many of us to speak aloud. The words don't come easily to our lips, especially when we are so practiced at justifying our regrettable actions, demonizing our so-called opponents, holding our grudges. A friend pointed out to me recently how utterly appropriate it is that we speak of nursing our resentments. For we often treat our bitterness with far more care than our joy. We can find so many reasons not to apologize, not to reconcile, and many of them make good common sense, or at least are defensible in our own minds. We carry those grudges like breakable glass, walking through life carefully preserving our anger and our resentment. And then Jesus says, we come to worship. And when we do, we find ourselves in the presence of God without the protective piety. We are vulnerable and fully present, and here is what happens. We remember. I find that worship evokes memory in a way nothing else can. That in this time set apart, we recall a word spoken in anger early in the week. We summon up in our minds an act of aggression toward a stranger. We cringe at that Facebook comment that, you know, the one that in the moment we viewed as a brilliant takedown of some lesser viewpoint. We regret the silent treatment toward our spouse or the quick temper toward our children. Here, the light of God is shined on those ways we have fallen short, and we remember. We remember what we have done and to whom we did it. As is so often the case, Fred Craddock said it best. He said, "Memory is a powerful stab of awakening to face our duty." If you're at the altar and you're offering your gift and then you remember, leave it. Leave the gift and go. It's urgent. Do it immediately. Don't wait. Delay is deadly. It festers. Trifles light as air will become proofs as strong as holy writ. And you will find yourself in a daily ritual of going into the backyard and lifting the stone to make sure the snake is still there. That it is now defining your life. Don't let that happen. Go immediately. Go first. Go right away. Craddock concludes, there is something that takes precedence over prayer, and that is my relationship to you. We know this to be true, that resentment is a prison we construct ourselves, that reconciliation is freedom, that confession is the key. When we offer that genuine and unconditional apology, we unlock the door and open the way to genuine worship of God, genuine relationship with one another. Now, I do mean, and I believe Jesus did mean, genuine apology. For we know the other kind as well, don't we? I'm sorry if you were offended by that. I'm sorry that you're so sensitive. Or just about any apology that begins, I'm sorry, but. Not hard to see how complicated these acts of apology are for we proud, stubborn human beings. That's why worship is the key. For when we are at the altar, when we are before God's righteous judgment and compassionate grace, we see our own failings in the light of divine mercy. We are free to acknowledge, as we just did, our frailty, our limitation, our failing. We are blessed to receive, as we just did, the gift of God's unconditional, prevenient forgiveness. And we are free to commit ourselves to another way, a better way, the way of forgiveness, the way of reconciliation. I wanted to preach on reconciliation these two Sundays after a bitter campaign ended with an election that revealed the depth of our division afresh. I wanted to speak to you about reconciliation because it is the path forward that God prescribes for us collectively and for each of us individually. It is the way toward truth and healing. And it is not easy. Not ever. Especially not now. I see and hear so many in our time whose resentment has become a raging fire that threatens to absolutely consume them. Some of us refuse to acknowledge the hurt we have caused. Others promise to exact revenge for past wounds. And so that cycle of abusive rhetoric and victimization continues unabated. What can possibly stop it? Come to the altar. Remember. Go and be reconciled, then, only then. Return to worship. This is the example that we, people of faith, can set for the world around us. We called to a higher standard of living. We called to a higher standard of forgiveness and confession. We know the truth of what Senator Alan Simpson observed at the funeral for President George H.W. Bush 2 years ago. Simpson said, I love this. He never hated anyone. He knew what his mother and my mother always knew, that hatred corrodes the container it's carried in. How many of our containers are corroded? How many of us have seen enough corrosion to know there must be a better way? I do believe we can choose that way beginning today and again tomorrow. You've heard me lament from this pulpit the extreme incivility and even hatred that have come to characterize public discourse and personal interaction in our time and place. This week, I invite you to imagine for just a moment the power and possibility in precisely this context that true forgiveness might enable. Imagine for just a moment in your mind the gift of honest confession, the freedom of release from guilt and shame, the release of a grudge held far too long, rotting our souls from the inside, isolating us from one another. Forgiveness is freedom. Not forgiving, author Anne Lamott writes, not forgiving is like drinking rat poison and expecting the rat to die. Do you remember the healing you felt when some person dear to you spoke those powerful words, "I forgive you," and they meant it? I don't mean to meddle, but maybe there's someone whom you've been struggling to forgive or whose forgiveness you have longed to receive. My counsel, drawn from Matthew chapter 5, is this: don't wait. Don't wait. Leave this time of worship, seek them out, and be reconciled to one another. Embrace the power of forgiveness. Several months ago, I was rushing to the grocery store to pick something up. I was on the way home from the office, and as I recall, it was something we desperately needed for dinner, and dinner was due to start as soon as I got home. I was late, I was in a hurry, and my gas gauge had fallen below the E. Of course, that particular evening, the parking lot of the grocery store was crowded. After one quick sweep through the lot, I spotted an empty space near the door. It was a miracle. That spot reserved just for me. Relieved, I turned right and pulled into the spot. And as I got out of the car, I both saw and heard for the first time another driver who had clearly arrived in that same space a little before me and had her left turn signal blinking, planning to pull into that spot I had just occupied. It is enough to say the other driver was irate. She laid on the horn, made a gesture, then put down her window and began to yell as she pulled into a spot farther down the row. I froze in the parking lot trying to decide what to do next. After all, I was in a hurry. I had an obligation to meet. I was running behind, and the issue was irrelevant at this point. She had a spot, I had a spot, so I took two steps toward the front door of the grocery store, but in that moment, something somewhere made me stop, and I decided to turn around and walk up to the other driver who was, by this point, getting out of her car. "I'm sorry," I said. I'm very sorry. I was in a hurry. I didn't see you. I should have been paying attention." With that, I braced myself for reaction. The woman looked down at the ground. "It's not you," she said. "I'm just exhausted. I'm sorry for blowing up." With that, she looked up and I saw tears in her eyes. We walked together toward the store and laughed about how badly we both wanted that closest spot, about how we both needed some ray of light in a difficult and hectic time. As we walked into the grocery store and turned separate ways at the entrance, the woman turned back to me and said, "I want to thank you for speaking to me. I want to thank you for apologizing. I think this is what will really turn my day around." A key turned in the lock for me that day. Two strangers saw each other for just a moment, as two flawed, frayed human beings doing the best we could. It was a tiny act of reconciliation, but one that I pray we will both always remember. Confession. Forgiveness. A gift from God, a call to follow. A practice that might yet save us from ourselves. Call us to the better angels of our nature. If you are at the altar and you remember, well, you know what to do.